This is the Berkeley Signal.
States is continuing to ratchet up pressure on the Venezuelan government in an attempt to topple President Nicolas Maduro. On Tuesday, the State Department announced it's giving control of Venezuela's U.S. bank accounts to opposition leader Juan Guaido, who declared himself president of Venezuela last week. This came a day after the U.S. imposed a de facto embargo on oil from Venezuela's state-run oil company, PDVSA. The new sanctions include exemptions for several U.S. firms, including Chevron and Halliburton, to allow them to continue working in Venezuela. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also refused to rule out a military invasion of Venezuela. On Monday, National Security Advisor John Bolton was photographed holding a notepad on which he had written the words 5,000 troops to Colombia. Earlier today, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro tweeted, quote, "People of the U.S., I ask for your support to reject the interference of Donald Trump's government in making my homeland a Vietnam in Latin America. Don't allow it," he tweeted. President Maduro told a Russian news network Wednesday he was open to negotiating with the opposition. Major opposition protests are planned for today. On Tuesday, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights criticized the Venezuelan government for cracking down on earlier protests. According to the UN, at least 40 people have been killed and 850 detained since the recent round of anti-government protests began. On Tuesday, Vice President Mike Pence met with members of the Venezuelan opposition at the White House. Trump's new special special envoy to Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, also took part in the meetings. Elliot Abrams is a right-wing hawk who was convicted in 1991 for lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal, but he was later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush. Abrams defended Guatemalan dictator General Efraín Ríos Montt as he oversaw a campaign of mass murder and torture of indigenous people in Guatemala in the 1980s. Ríos Montt was later convicted of genocide. Abrams was also linked to the 2002 coup in Venezuela that attempted to topple Hugo Chavez. Today, we spend the hour looking at the crisis in Venezuela and the appointment of Elliot Abrams as special envoy. We're joined by the award-winning investigative journalist Alan Nairn, who's closely tracked Elliot Abrams' record for over three decades. Alan Nairn is two-time winner of the George Polk Award, a recipient of the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Award for International Reporting. Alan spoke with us earlier this week from Jakarta, Indonesia. He began by talking about the significance of the appointment of Elliot Abrams.
What his appointment emphasizes, re-emphasizes, it was already obvious, was that the U.S. is trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela and that it will be willing to use violence, to use military force if necessary. That's what Abrams and indeed U.S. policy has been all about. I think their first preference would be to have a successful covert operation. Mike Pompeo, when he was in charge of the CIA, all but stated it publicly at one point when he was speaking in Aspen at one of those gatherings of the elite, he gave the rough outlines of an operation in coordination with U.S. allies like Colombia to topple the Maduro government in Venezuela. And now, just recently, the night before Guaido declared himself as the new president of Venezuela, he was on the phone with Mike Pence directly. The Wall Street Journal broke the story. Pence was directly talking to him, and the next day he comes out and declares himself as the president of Venezuela. And now, they're offering incentives to Venezuelan army officers to come over to their side and hoping that the U.S. can reestablish control of Venezuela in that manner. But if that fails, I think there is a chance that the U.S. would consider an invasion of Venezuela. This would not be the first or even the second or third preference of the Pentagon or the CIA or the State Department, but it might be very attractive to Donald Trump. For several reasons. In 2016, during the campaign, speaking of Iraq, Trump said, "To the victor belong the spoils. You have to go in and take the oil." You could call this a Trump doctrine. And Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves. Now, very often, oil is used as the explanation for the motive for U.S. invasions and foreign policy, and I think its role is usually way overblown. People give it too much weight in the analysis. But in this case, it might turn out to be very relevant, given that Trump has that doctrine and is now personally in power. Secondly, politically, Trump needs a new war. Trump has been stuck with, for him, being in the embarrassing position of just being able to continue the old W. Bush and Obama wars. There's a consensus among U.S. mainstream historians that no president can be great unless he has a war. They say this all the time. And Trump now, of course, is in some political difficulty. So for him, an action where the U.S. went into Venezuela in spectacular fashion, did it quick, in the style of the U.S. invasions of Grenada or Panama, didn't get bogged down, but just went in, say, for a few weeks, killed without restraint, which is the doctrine Trump is now applying to U.S. forces worldwide. I mean, he's basically told the CIA and the Pentagon, don't worry about any constraints on civilian casualties that may have existed before. Do what you will. In fact, in Afghanistan, he celebrated the dropping of what was called the mother of all bombs, this massive explosive, which is the closest conventional explosive that you can get to a nuclear weapon. This was dropped in a mountainous region of Afghanistan, and Trump was crowing about it afterwards. So a quick invasion with massive force that succeeds in toppling the Maduro government and then where the U.S. gets out quickly is the kind of thing that could, in theory, be attractive to Trump. And it's also the kind of thing that I guarantee you would be praised to the heavens on CNN and on MSNBC. And this would be a sweet political victory for Trump. Whether it's actually possible to pull off a quick, successful military invasion of Venezuela is entirely a different question, because it would face major resistance. Even if, you know, some of the army had already switched sides to the U.S. side, there would be a lot of people who would want to resist it. But it is the case that the reality in Venezuela today is very different than it has been during earlier years of the Bolivarian movement in Venezuela. The U.S. doesn't care at all about elections. They don't care at all about the poor. Completely fake elections are fine with them. The U.S. just not long ago finished ratifying a fraudulent election in Honduras, where Hernandez imposed himself for re-election, and he did that with the assistance of Mike Pence and others. They don't care about the poor. They targeted Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian movement from the beginning. In 2002, even though Chavez had not long before been reelected in a clean vote, a completely clean vote, for years, the Carter Center and other international monitors who went to Venezuela was reporting that their electoral system was, in that era, they did a clean count. They were not rigged elections. Despite that, despite the fact that the Chavez administration was making great strides in raising living standards for the poor, starting to lower the levels of malnutrition, starting to raise the levels of general health, or maybe because of that, the U.S. in 2002 backed a coup against Chavez that briefly removed him but was ultimately unsuccessful because the population and much of the security forces rallied to Chavez's side and they thwarted the U.S. effort to oust him. Today, it's a different situation. The U.S. has been trying to undermine the Venezuelan government ever since the Chavez years, as has the Venezuelan oligarchy. In fact, not long after the brief failed coup, which was backed by the U.S., the rich of Venezuela, the business owners, went on a capital strike. They purposely shut down their businesses, and it had huge impact. They succeeded in shaving something like 27% off the gross domestic product of Venezuela, which is just astonishing, catastrophic in a short time. But even that failed to topple Chavez. But in the conditions we have today, where Maduro does not have near the popular support that Chavez did, where he's really been running the country into the ground and has been using the fact that the U.S. is trying to undermine the government as a universal excuse for everything, for his own incompetence and corruption and brutality against protesters in the streets, the Maduro government is in a rather weak position. And it appears that the population is now becoming rather divided. For years, the opposition in Venezuela was kind of a classical rightist Latin American force, with the very rich, the oligarchs, top business people aligned with many sectors of the middle class. But now it seems that opposition has spread and there are many poor people who are part of it. So this means this Maduro government is rather weak and is vulnerable to being toppled. It is possible. It's not impossible as it was in previous years under Chavez. But, and this is important to note, even though much of the U.S. news coverage and many of the U.S. analysts note the fact that a lot of poor people are now joining and going into the streets protesting against Maduro, there is absolutely no way that the U.S. will allow a poor people's movement. Imagine if such a thing came into being, a poor people's movement in Venezuela that did want to oust Maduro, but replace it with a new policy that was also pro-poor and sought to gain justice. There's no way the U.S. would tolerate that. The U.S. will insist that a new opposition that comes to power be controlled by the far-right elements who represent the very rich and are willing to take instructions from Washington, as was clearly illustrated in the case of Pence and the newly self-proclaimed president of Venezuela. So it's a very dangerous situation right now. And I think the proper role for the U.S. at this moment is, one, to lift the sanctions, lift the stranglehold that is currently increasing the level of hunger. There's a level of misery in Venezuela that was already caused by the incompetence of this government. But the U.S. has done everything it can to increase it. Just in the past few days, for example, the U.S. has been moving legally to block the Venezuelan government from using $1.2 billion worth of gold, which it has stored in London. And in doing this, they're being backed by the opposition, by Guaido. And this will mean less money available in Venezuela to buy basic provisions, basic supplies, food, medicine, etc. So lift the stranglehold, and secondly, disavow the invasion option, and then step back. You know, some people in the Democratic Party, for example, in the United States, float the idea of the U.S. trying to facilitate, be the mediator in finding a political solution for Venezuela. But that's not appropriate. The U.S. has no standing to be a mediator, a disinterested third party. The U.S. is on one side. They're on the side of the right and the rich in Venezuela who are trying to topple this government. And the U.S. is trying to overthrow the government. They can't be a mediator. It's somewhat comparable to Israel-Palestine, where for years the U.S. has claimed to be an honest broker between Israel and the Palestinians, when in fact, everyone knows, it's self-proclaimed, the U.S. is on the side of the Israelis and against the aspirations of the Palestinians to have their legal rights under international law enforced and to regain their political sovereignty. And yet they claim to be a mediator. So the U.S. should not try to insert itself and claim to be a political mediator in Venezuela either. For that, you'd need an outside party that has some credibility. Maybe, you know, a figure like the Pope or some outside countries who could play that role. A couple of years ago, the Pope was involved in such an effort, but he received no backing from the U.S. at the time because they don't really want a political solution that leads to a truly open political field where all options are available, where perhaps maybe a different government, but one that is pro-poor and anti-U.S. could gain power. You know, if you had a genuinely open political process in Venezuela, a political outcome like that is certainly not inconceivable, but the U.S. would never tolerate that. They're now trying to engineer a way for the U.S. to regain control. And to do that, they'll be willing to use violence if necessary. And for that, Abrams is the perfect man for the job. Abrams was the key man in Reagan administration policy toward Central America when that administration was abetting what a court recently ruled was a genocide in Guatemala, when the U.S. was backing the army of El Salvador in a series of death squad assassinations and massacres, and when the U.S. was invading Nicaragua with a Contra force that went after what one U.S. general described as soft targets, meaning civilians, things like cooperatives. Abrams later came back during the George W. Bush administration, joined the National Security Council, and was a key man in implementing the U.S. policy of backing Israeli attacks against Gaza when the U.S. refused to accept the results of the Gaza elections, where Hamas defeated Fatah in a vote, and instead Abrams and company backed a war operation to overturn the results of the election, backing the forces of Mohammed Dahlan. Some commentators have said, well, Abrams is not a Trump guy. He represents traditional established U.S. foreign policy, and that's true. The problem is that that U.S. policy has been to abet genocide when the U.S. feels it's necessary. In the case of Guatemala, the Abrams and the Reagan administration were approving the shipment of weapons, money, intelligence, and the provision of political cover to the army of Guatemala as they were sweeping through the northwest Mayan highlands, wiping out 662 rural villages by the army's own count, decapitating children, crucifying people, using the tactics that in this era we associate with ISIS. In one particular case, in 1985, an activist for the relatives of the disappeared, named Rosario Godoy, was abducted by the army. She was raped. Her mutilated body was found alongside that of her baby. The baby's fingernails had been torn out. The Guatemalan army, when asked about this atrocity, said, oh, they died in a traffic accident. When Elliot Abrams was asked about this accident, he affirmed also that they died in a traffic accident. This activist raped and mutilated the baby with his fingernails pulled out. Abrams says it's a traffic accident. It's very parallel to the stance Abrams took on Panama. When Noriega, the CIA-backed dictator of Panama, who was involved in the drug traffic, who the U.S. later decided to overthrow, when the forces of Noriega abducted the Panamanian dissident Hugo Spadafora and cut off his head with a kitchen knife, Jesse Helms, of all people, tried to investigate in the U.S. Congress, and Elliot Abrams stopped him, saying, no, we need Noriega. He's doing a very good job. He's working with us. In the case of El Salvador, after the massacre in El Mozote, where a U.S. trained battalion massacred more than 500 civilians, slitting the throats of children along the way. Abrams took the lead in denying that such a thing had ever happened, and he later described the results of the Reagan administration policy, his policy in El Salvador, as a fabulous achievement. He said this even after the Salvador Truth Commission had issued a report saying that more than 85% of the atrocities had been committed by the armed forces and its death squads. Death squads which had a particular practice of cutting off the genitals of their victims, stuffing them in their mouths, and putting them on open display on the roadsides of El Salvador. When I appeared on the Charlie Rose TV show with Elliot Abrams, I suggested that he be put on trial, that he be brought before a Nuremberg-style tribunal and tried for his role in facilitating war crimes and crimes against humanity. He dismissed the idea of him being put on trial as ludicrous, but he did not actually deny any of the facts of what he had done. He said it was all necessary in the context of the Cold War. So this is Elliot Abrams, who has now been put in charge of key aspects of the U.S. policy toward Venezuela.
A new study about Greenland's ice sheet has found that the rate of melting is four times greater than it was 16 years ago. If all of Greenland's ice sheet melts, a clear result of global warming, it will mean a 23-foot rise in sea levels, submerging Florida's southern tip. The good news is that a record number of Americans now believe human-caused global warming is a thing. A Yale University poll has found that 72% of Americans acknowledge the reality of climate change, a large swing from previous years. Perhaps it is because the evidence is all around us, from wildfires in California to deadly hurricanes multiple times a year. But what if this collective realization has come too late? We have lost precious decades due to inaction fueled by well-funded efforts to deny climate change. Today, we'll examine who has led those efforts and why. My guest is Amy Westervelt. She's an audio and print reporter covering climate and gender. Her podcast, Drilled, is about the creation and spread of climate denial. Welcome to the program, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
We know that there has been this tendency in the media to treat climate change as an issue that they have to strive to offer balance in. Let's quote the scientists, but then also quote the skeptics. But that wasn't always the case, was it? There was a time when it was completely non-controversial to accept the very physics-based idea that if you pump our atmosphere full of greenhouse gases, it will heat up.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't always that way. I mean, it was a bipartisan issue for a really long time. And then you sort of see a turn in the late 80s to early 90s where fossil fuel companies sort of shift from thinking, well, if we're involved in the science and we're kind of a part of everyone trying to figure out how to address this, then we'll have a say in, you know, the regulatory framework and things like that, to, okay, this could really hurt our industry, let's just squash it. And they just started investing hundreds of millions of dollars in these very well-orchestrated, comprehensive campaigns. And part of that was targeting media and kind of accusing media of being biased if they ever ran a story about climate science or climate change without talking to the quote-unquote other side, which of course were all mostly funded by the industry or industry-funded think tanks and things like that.
So the denialists accused media outlets of bias, something that media outlets don't like to be accused of. They like to assume this role of objectivity. But when it comes to an issue of science, how does climate change compare to other issues? I mean, does the media have the same so-called balanced approach when they're reporting on, say, cancer studies?
I haven't seen any case that mirrors what's happened with climate change. And I got to figure that that's just a result of the huge volume of efforts and money and everything else that went into this disinformation campaign. So, you know, like when the media covers the impacts of secondhand smoke, for example, they don't go and talk to a tobacco industry executive or like a scientist who works for Philip Morris, you know? And for some reason, it's just been an effective strategy here. I think, you know, for a few different reasons. There's the complexity of climate science. And then there's the fact that the way that scientists talk about it is cloaked in uncertainty too. And I think a lot of media people covering the issue maybe didn't necessarily know that that's just sort of how scientists talk about everything. The industry did a really good job of spinning a normal amount of scientific uncertainty. You know, they'll never conclusively say anything because there's always room for more exploration. And also everyone's always trying to get more funding for their next study, right? So I think the industry did a really good job of taking that and making it seem like it was uncertainty the way we talk about uncertainty in the rest of the world.
Now, you point out in an op-ed that you wrote for the Washington Post, where you gave an overview of this denialism, that the first step was targeting media outlets, but then the second step was targeting conservatives with the message that climate change was a liberal hoax. This was something that I hadn't heard about. Tell us a little bit more about that.
They did a ton of market research and focus groups, and they started out with, like, you know, various demographics to see who is and isn't kind of susceptible to this message. And the folks who were most susceptible tended to be mostly white male conservatives. And you'll see even still, like, it's by like 90% or something, the vast majority of climate deniers still fit into that category.
So they picked that target and they began grooming certain figures whose entire job it was to be media spokespeople who could very effectively sound intelligent about climate change. What was the sort of tactic that they used? Did these figures acknowledge that there was some problem of climate change, but that it was still being debated? Or did they just straight out say climate change is a complete hoax?
It was kind of a mix of things in the beginning, but it pretty quickly went to, you know, some acknowledgement that climate was changing, but always that, you know, we didn't necessarily know why, and we didn't necessarily know what the impacts would be. And we couldn't say that it was just from fossil fuel emissions or human emissions in general. And this was very similar to what happened with the tobacco industry too, where they would fund actually legitimate science that was focused on all the other things that also contribute to global warming in an effort to sort of divert attention. So it's like volcanoes and, you know, sunspots and looking at sort of the historical data. So they would also do things like talk about how the data was incomplete because the models were so new, and just any way that they could kind of create the notion that there was still a lot to be learned and still a lot of doubt about what was happening, well past the point where there was scientific consensus.
What about the Heartland Institute? I recall getting these beautiful, slickly produced brochures in the mail from the Heartland Institute about climate change and climate science. And then if you actually started to read these brochures, you would see it was filled with denialist ideas. And I would wonder, why would they spend their money and send it to someone like me? Or they're clearly very, very well funded. Tell us what role the Heartland Institute has played in promoting climate change denialism.
They're one of a handful of largely industry-funded think tanks that sprung up. You know, it's this sort of interesting history with all of these think tanks that kind of sprang up in the 70s and 80s as a response to the social movements of the 60s. There was a real, like, crisis in corporate America at that time because they'd kind of been the good guys, you know, for a while. And all of a sudden, they're like, everyone's turning on us. We have to do something about this. And there was this whole, you know, the conservative war of ideas thing happening, and the Heartland Institute sprang up about that time, and they have been a major funder of climate denialism. They have a whole bunch of so-called experts that they fund who, you know, show up every time there's some climate change issue being debated in the news. They write amicus briefs in every lawsuit. And then, yeah, they do this thing of sending out materials to people. There's been even some amount of sending school teachers some of the denialist stuff too, which is, you know, concerning. But then, you know, the other interesting thing too is that at the same time that they're funding these think tanks and front groups and all that kind of stuff, and also a lot of fake media outlets. You know, on the one hand, you would think, well, they should be paying for more research because they should be paying to help figure out the problem, right? But on the other hand, the fact that they have that much invested in the research has given them a large amount of control, even at the academic level. So, like, I've talked to several researchers who are like, yeah, like, they definitely influence what gets researched. They have a huge focus on very long-term solutions because that won't hurt their business in the short term. Or technologies that sort of enable the fossil fuel kind of infrastructure to continue as is. I feel like that's the big reason they're also keen to brace algae. It's so embedded in so many parts of society and like every step of the information chain.
How effective was the climate denial propaganda?
In the early 90s, when they were starting to do a lot more of this like focus group and really figuring out where to target the message and stuff, the fossil fuel companies did their own research on this question of like who believed what and whether it was partisan or not. And they found that bipartisan 80% of Americans believed in climate change. And so now, 30 years later, we've like barely gotten to, you know, within striking distance of where we were at. So I feel like that's a good indicator of how successful it was. And because it was so embedded in all these different areas, they were able to sort of like enlist a lot of surrogates. And I would say even the media kind of played a role in that respect too, that I think a lot of journalists and editors and stuff will say like, oh, well, you know, they weren't influencing us because in their minds, it's like there was never some slick oil executive showing up at my desk telling me not to run a story, right? But like the influence is so much more subtle than that. And it does show up throughout the 2000s. There were so many news stories that like every single time they covered climate change would have a denier's voice in there. It worked. It was below 50% of people believing for quite a bit of time there.
The primary means by which people share information today in this decade especially is social media. And it was a new and extremely disturbing report showing that tech companies like Google, Facebook, and Microsoft sponsored a conference promoting climate change denial. They were sponsors of LibertyCon, which is this libertarian student group that took place in Washington, D.C. Incredibly, Google gave that conference $25,000 and Facebook and Microsoft gave it $10,000 each. This was a group that was promoting climate change denialism. So these social media companies seem to be just as irresponsible, if not more so, than traditional media outlets.
I was having that same thought when I read that story, because they take a very similar tack in like sort of excusing that funding too. Very similar to, you know, if you ask media, like for example, I wrote this op-ed in the Washington Post and a bunch of people got ads from oil companies on top of that op-ed. Same thing happened, like Catherine Hayhoe, the climate scientist, wrote an op-ed in Washington Post and then was on CNN talking about the latest climate assessment. And like all around her interviews were ads for, you know, a book from the Heartland Institute about how renewable energy is bunk and like, you know, things like that. And the media will just say like, oh, you know, especially like on the editorial side, people will say, oh, well, we don't have anything to do with that. And then even the ad sales folks will say like, oh, well, you know, the ads just show up on the website. And like, we don't know what ad is going where and whatnot, which is like, you know, okay, sure. But Facebook and Google were like, oh, well, you know, we support lots of different organizations and, you know, we're aligned with them on the like tech and social issues. And that's like our focus. So like, it doesn't really matter that they're also big, you know, pushers of climate denial. And I just don't think that's true. When people see you as aligned with that group, they see you as aligned with all of it. Similarly, like if someone is reading a story and they see this like, you know, Exxon ad above it, that is going to automatically undermine whatever reporting they're reading on climate. And I think I would like to see companies just take a little more responsibility for that and realize what kind of mixed messages they're sending the public when they decide to use their platform or their money to support these organizations.
Tell me about the podcast that you're doing, Drilled. This is a podcast where you identify the creation of climate denial as the crime of the century.
Yeah, I mean, I see it as definitely the propaganda campaign that is going to cause the most harm and already has. It was incredibly well orchestrated. I mean, that's the thing is like, it was so successful that they're now being sued over it. If it had failed, there probably wouldn't be lawsuits or protests or people arguing about how to act swiftly on climate. And the biggest issue is if the denial campaigns had happened in the 40s, and then by the time it got to the 70s and 80s, we had worked our way back to 72% like we are now, it would have been fine. You know, we would have like gotten on track and potentially made a slow but steady transition. Now we're in a place where we have to act quickly and we have to push for very radical change, which is a lot harder to do. And we're going to see losses regardless because it has been too many years lost.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Sit-ins and picket lines for civil rights, dogs and water hoses, crosses burning in the night. Was down in Mississippi that Emmett Till was lynched, then down in Texas James Byrd was dragged and ditched. James Byrd, a righteous name I know, just change that James to Jim and the bird is still a crow. Change, change, nothing has changed. Change, change, nothing has changed. Washed and ironed all the white folks' clothes, nursed their babies, now she works in nursing homes. Had to be twice as good to get half a chance. Still fired first and hired last. They talk about a glass ceiling, now don't you know? She's down on her knees on a concrete floor. Change, change, nothing has changed. Change, change, nothing has changed. Landless against the landlord at home or abroad, nothing's really changed for what it's worth. They got you coming, got you going, it's all based on greed. You rent to own and the interest make you bleed.
family used to buy from the master at the company store. Now call it MasterCard, it keeps the people poor. Change, change, nothing has changed. Change, change, nothing has changed. KKK and the Nazis march in Charlottesville, spewing hate, carrying guns, wanting blood to spill. They are saluting Hitler and their president. They wave their rebel flags like the war ain't over yet. Some who stand against them for democracy is true. Star-spangled love in the red, white, and blue. Change, change, nothing has changed. Change, change, nothing has changed. How can I be angry? There's been some changes, true. Too slowly in my lifetime, there's much more we can do. Anytime a child is hungry, anytime they're homeless men, anytime there are no doctors and there is no medicine, anytime there's ethnic cleansing, anytime there's genocide, anytime there's been a hate crime and freedom's been denied, anytime there's been a war and religious persecution, a shepherd or a Trayvon, another fatal shooting, anytime there is a ghetto, anytime a reservation, anytime we meet up face to face with discrimination. How can I be angry? There's been some changes, true. Too slowly in my lifetime, much more we can do. Gotta make a change. Here we are, 2018, and the government is ripping babies from their mothers, tearing families apart, putting them in cages. And why am I not surprised? Why am I not surprised? Horrified, but not surprised, because it's been done before. Oh yes, it's been done before, hundreds of years ago. Nothing's changed. Oh, nothing's changed. Will it change? Can it change? Oh, it's gotta change. It's gotta change. 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 Change.
Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich and I'm very happy to welcome back to this radio station, Dar Jamel. Good to see you. Welcome back.
You too, Mitch. It's great to be back.
Why did you turn your attention to climate change? Because I think many of our listeners, as I said, probably remember you from this radio station anyways, this airways, from all the work that you did in Iraq.
Absolutely. I moved up to Alaska in 1996 and got immediately into mountain climbing. And at that moment, already the really obvious signs of climate change were there, you know, watching receding glaciers, crazy weather anomalies already happening in the mid-90s up there as the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the globe. So the seed was planted then, really, for my shift into this reportage and certainly the book. And so that always stayed with me, even all through Iraq, all of that time reporting, being overseas. I was always kind of, at least cursorily, still watching what was happening in the Arctic. And so that's really where this book started.
Tell me more about your experience, your relationship to Alaska.
I go into the mountains. That's where I really reconnect in to the earth. I sometimes refer to mountains as my church. It's where I go to listen. It's where I go to really have my kind of ongoing dialogue with the planet and keep perspective and stay sane as things get crazier and crazier outside of those realms. And so, but then being there, it's been a bittersweet experience in that as much as I love these places and go there and have that exchange and find that peace, it's also a time of watching them go away, watching glaciers vanish, watching entire ecosystems change and species changing and oftentimes going away. You see it firsthand. I mean, anyone that goes out and has a consistent, intimate relationship with a place on the planet, whether it's in the forest or in the oceans over reefs or whether it's in the mountains on glaciers, you cannot avoid the reality of how fast all these things are changing.
I mean, I think many of us have seen pictures of glaciers 20 years ago compared to now, but even more effective is when I talk to people and they tell me about that experience, especially in Alaska, how significantly some of these glaciers have shrunk.
Right. Even on Denali, the highest point in North America, you know, over 20,000 feet high, I went up there for the book in 2016, and one of the lead mountaineering rangers, Tucker Chenoweth, told me, he said, look, you know, even just since you know, you were climbing up here up until 2003 real regularly. And just from then to now, in 13 years, we've seen so much dramatic melting of the bigger glaciers up there that, for example, the camps on Denali were referred to as their elevation number. So Base Camp 72, Camp 178, going up to 11-2 Camp, etc. He said all the camps below the 14,200-foot camp, the glaciers are receding and diminishing so quickly that those elevations are no longer accurate. We're going to have to find new names for these camps. Glacier National Park, which, you know, many people are familiar with this, and I went out with the U.S. Geological Survey lead glaciologist there, Dr. Dan Fagry, and he took me out for a day, and we talked, and he showed me things, and the iconic Glacier National Park, according to Dr. Fagry, is most likely not going to have any functional glaciers by 2030. That's just 11 years from now. So again, you know, we're going to have a naming problem, but more dramatically, he and several other of the scientists that I interviewed for my glaciers chapter in the book spoke, pointing to the fact that it's likely that by 2100, there won't be any alpine glaciers anywhere left on the entire planet. That will mean for humans directly major drinking water and lack of irrigation for farming issues. I mean, right now as we speak, 250 million people across the world rely on glaciers as their sole source of drinking water. What happens when those are gone? What do those people do? Right now as we speak, some of the major rivers in Asia, they originate in portions of the Himalaya, and those rivers provide drinking water and irrigation for 1.5 billion people as we speak. What happens when those either are greatly diminished or go away completely? So again, you can see we already have water wars. We already have potential water war between India and Pakistan over Kashmir water. So these things are going to escalate. But then also for other species, if you take glaciers, for example, out of the valley where it is, all the species of fish and insects that rely on that stream being a certain temperature because of that glacier being there, when that's gone, those species go away. And then all the species up the food chain from those, you know, the species that ate those fish and those insects, where do they go? And then what happens on the land when water availability is diminished for certain trees and they stop growing? What about all the species that live in those trees? And so there are these cascading effects and all of these unforeseen consequences just by losing glaciers.
Speaking of water wars, I mean, even the Pentagon takes something like that seriously.
They have been actually planning for this and warning for it for over 10 years now. They release, and I remember reporting on this even when I was still reporting from Iraq, in their Quadrennial Defense Review report. Yeah. That comes out every year. And I can remember specifically as far back as at least 2006, if not before that. But that year comes to mind that they were already talking about climate change as being the single largest security threat to the United States. And it was because of things like this, that when people don't have food and water, countries become destabilized and you start having big problems, i.e. the Arab Spring.
And then another effect of the melting ice is the release of methane, which it's actually going to increase the problem.
Exactly. So I went up to the furthest north point in North America, which is in Alaska, a town formerly known as Barrow, which has since been renamed more recently to its native name, which is Utqiagvik. And I went up there to interview experts who were investigating what's happening to the thawing permafrost, which the entire north slope of Alaska is built upon. And that is thawing out. So again, we're going to run into a name problem here because it's no longer permanent. And there are, at last count, 37 villages across Alaska that, as the permafrost thaws, are literally going to have to be relocated if they're built on permafrost or right on the edge of the Arctic Ocean or on a riverbank. All of that is melting away and changing, so they're going to have to be moved. And then if you take that permafrost as it goes under the Arctic Ocean in the shallow seas, in that subsea permafrost are what are called methane hydrates. It's methane that's trapped in the ice. And as the ocean warms up and that subsea permafrost is starting to thaw out, as it is, we're having increasing methane releases. And so one of the scientists that I talked to in the book, Dr. Ira Leifer, has been studying this for a long time and has already published peer-reviewed studies on this, and has already, as far back as 2012, found dramatic incidents of increase in subsea methane, even from pretty deep out in the Arctic Ocean, that's already being released. And the problem is methane is a far more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2. It's 100 times more potent on a 10-year time scale. And And as that methane is being released and there's enough there, we could look at massive releases happening quite suddenly. We are now starting to see consistent releases. There's lakes on the terrestrial permafrost above ground where already there's enough methane underneath those leaking out. You look out at the lake and it looks like it's fizzing and bubbling.
And we're locked into this. All the carbon dioxide and methane that we put in the atmosphere, if we didn't put any more in there, it's going to take 20,000 years.
That's right. For the Earth, given enough time to do its job to completely basically clean itself of what we've added to it. And that's one of the harder parts of the book, and one of the harder parts, I think, for all of us to really let sink in, that if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions on a dime globally right now, what is already baked into the system is, even with our best mitigation efforts on top of stopping fossil fuel emissions, but finding ways to sequester CO2 out of the atmosphere, planting more trees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we're locked into probably a minimum of 3C increase by 2100, yeah, which is catastrophic at a level that I think most people don't realize. And a key part of this is that oceans have absorbed over 93% of all the heat that we've added to the atmosphere. That is enough heat that if the oceans hadn't done that, our atmosphere today would be 97 degrees warmer than it already is right now. So think about the change that's causing in the oceans. And we look at these more recent reports just in the last few weeks, a sixfold increase in melting across the Antarctic since just the 1970s, dramatic melting accelerating across Greenland. The majority of this is now happening because the oceans are so warm and things are melting from beneath. So we've locked in a vast amount of sea level rise, regardless of what we do at this point. So we have to talk about adaptation, both physically as well as internally, to this dramatically changed world that we're living in, and kind of get past this kind of bargaining stage of, well, maybe if we do this, we can keep doing this, and maybe this new technology will save us, and really understand that we're looking at irreversible changes that are already locked in. The question is, how are we going to adapt, and how can we still perhaps find some way to mitigate? So instead of going to some of these catastrophic levels, maybe it'll be like not quite as catastrophic.
What do you think about these technologies or attempts to develop technologies to capture the carbon that is out in the atmosphere now?
There's no technology that exists that is scalable to the level that would be required to sequester enough carbon from the atmosphere to actually make a difference and really cause some serious mitigation. So you're talking about having to draw out hundreds of billions of tons of CO2 from the atmosphere while we're still adding about 40 billion tons every single year and currently accelerating.
You compare our moment and our future to what was known as the Permian extinction. What was that?
So the Permian mass extinction, you'll hear it sometimes referred to as the Great Dying, occurred roughly 252 million years ago. And most scientists believe that the cause of this was a giant event of volcanism across Siberia that released a massive amount of CO2 into the atmosphere, basically a massive volcano. And that CO2 warmed the atmosphere, as what we're seeing happening right now. And then it warmed it to the point where the subsea methane hydrates in the Arctic released, and all that methane kicked in. And then that was actually the event of that mass extinction. That event took place over 80,000 years. And what we've done right now in a short span of roughly 250 years since the Industrial Revolution began is we have injected so much CO2 in the atmosphere. Just to give you geologic perspective, the last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, oceans were 60 to 70 feet higher. We are now living in the consequences, and will live in the consequences of this dominant paradigm of the industrial growth society for as long as our species continues.
I'm not sure we can stop it.
We are at a point now where we have to start thinking about adaptation, because it essentially means we have to change the entire economy, how we all live, how everything is done. And when you look at it, it brings up these feelings of hopelessness and overwhelm and depression and a lot of grief. And, you know, what do we even do? Because when you really understand the scope of the problem and what would be required to try to even mitigate it, it feels utterly overwhelming.
It would be my mistake to allow my pessimism to shadow over the work that all the activists that are doing. What do you think can happen? Is there a saving grace?
I have had to really let go of being attached to the results of my actions. I mean, I'd like to think that I would write this book and people would read it deeply and, you know, go back out and reconnect to the planet and start making their decisions from that starting point, not some other starting point, but really listen to the planet and say, okay, what does she want me to do for her today? I've had to let go of all of that. And really, I think it comes down to, how do we want to be today? What good work do we want to find that we can do? And, you know, the results are completely out of our hands, but how do I choose to comport myself today in this time, at this point in history, where we all know what's baked into the system? We have a really good idea of what's coming. It is going to be catastrophic. There's nothing going to change that. So from that starting point, what's most important in my life? Who are the most important people in my life? And what do I need to try to do to live the right way today at this point in history? And I think that will radically kind of redefine and change, you know, if there's any sticking point or, oh, maybe the risk isn't worth it or whatever, or maybe there's more time. There's not. The time to take the radical changes and meaning to get down to the root, ideally from our hearts, of how are we going to live our lives today to be most in accord with what we really believe in, and how can we best serve the planet? And ideally, that's the place where I'm making my decisions from today. And I think that's the single most important experience I've had as a result of going to all these places around the world and writing this book and seeing so clearly how far along we already are, that literally within a decade, there'll probably be no more Great Barrier Reef, there'll be no more glaciers in Glacier National Park, and really understanding what this really means. And so at this point in history, how are we going to be?
To live deliberately.
Yes.
Yeah.
And consciously, and not distracted, and staying focused on what's really, really important, and what good work can we do today.
You write about grief.
I have to. I mean, I think we all have to. I mean, I'm emotional now talking about this part of it, because we're talking about the loss of so many species and life and humans. As we speak, there's people dying every day around the world from climate change. I mean, here we are in California. I don't need to talk to your audience about wildfires and drought and other impacts and rising seas here in the Bay Area. I mean, it's upon us. And if you live in paradise, you're already in this post-apocalyptic future. You've already lost everything. Here we are in this bubble where it feels as though it's not happening here, but it is. And to really take all of this in deeply, I mean, you can't not be changed by it, but the doorway we all have to go through to really let that sink in and come out of it clearly on the other side is we have to grieve. And we have to really come from a place of, you know, feeling all that rage and sadness and despair and fear and all of these myriad emotions, and process through all of that and let it go through us to really come out like, okay, you know, I'm human. How can I not actually really feel that way if I know that some of my brothers and sisters are dying from this or suffering, and these species that we depend on way more than they depend on us? I mean, for example, there's no other species on the planet that's dependent upon human beings for its survival, but we're dependent on every single other species on the planet for our own survival, and we're losing them so quickly. And to let all that in, you can't not deal with the grief piece when we talk about this topic, if we're really talking about it honestly.
It's hard to watch. I even ask myself sometimes, as I'm seeing change happen, and it's not always just these pure, pristine places, but just as I see change happen, I have to ask myself, is it just that I'm getting older and I don't like change as much as I used to, and I'm not ready for it? But certainly hard to watch.
It's blatantly obvious, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Just, you know, anyone that's paying attention knows, like, the temperature and the seasons here are radically changing. There's less birdsong. There's less animals that I usually see. I mean, I intentionally went to places that I had a long-term relationship, like the Great Barrier Reef. I'd been there in the mid-90s, and then to go there in 2017, the first week of a major coral bleaching event that took out 30% of the entire reef. The next year, another bleaching event took out 20% of the entire reef. This is the single biggest coral ecosystem on the planet, 1,400 miles long, and it's vanishing before our eyes. And this is a giant alarm bell siren screaming in our faces right there for anyone to see who lives in this area. Are we listening? Because it's screaming at us, and are we listening? We have to each find ways to go back in and tap down into the earth and really, really listen. And if we listen the right way and close enough, then we're going to be told what we need to do.
Is it too late to save nature as it was, but we might still be able to recreate nature?
I don't know. I mean, that's another one of those things where
I was wondering that. I was on a rooftop park which I can't believe. In San Francisco is now closed down because there's all these structural problems with it. But it sort of made me think about this. Like, okay, they built these new high-rise buildings and everything. And on the top, they're putting these parks. Are we recreating nature? And is that possible?
I don't think it's possible. No. We, as a species, as smart as we like to think we are, you know, the best scientists I know, like using Tom Lovejoy as an example, you know, this is a guy, he's been studying the Amazon since 1965. Here we are, it's 2019. This is one of the leading biodiversity experts on the planet, if not the. And he says, you know what? We've barely scratched the surface. To think we can replicate nature, I mean, again, I come back to his saying, we think we are some godlike thing. And look at how far that's gotten us.
Yeah. Was there one spot that you went to for this book that profoundly touched you that we didn't talk about?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, everywhere I went, you know, the upswing of all of this is getting to go visit these places and be amidst the majesty and the power.
I mean, because your book's very poignant, obviously, as this conversation is. But it's also very well written. But beyond that, your descriptions of some of these places are quite beautiful. And it made me want to go there, you know, and made me excited to know that even as bad as things are, that these places actually still exist.
They are still here. And I'm really glad that we're going to end on that note. There are still glaciers. There is still the Amazon. There are still these trees with birds in them. And that's why it's still worth fighting for.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Woke up this morning, I couldn't go to work. 'Cause government can't govern. DC has gone berserk. Gotta feed my children, gotta pay my rent. But they're holding my paycheck hostage, and that I resent. I've got the blues. I've got the government shut down blues. And how about essential workers working every day for free? Still doing their jobs to protect you and me. They need that money, got to pay their bills. But the so-called leaders in Washington ain't got no leadership skills. They got the blues. They got the government shutdown blues. Don't tell us you can't relate. Don't say you feel our pain. None of you, Mr. Paycheck, do you have no shame? Don't say that we'll adjust, that we'll simply find a way to make ends meet after you hijacked our pay. We've got the blues. We've got the government shutdown blues.
I feel so abandoned. This just isn't right.
My children are hungry.
How can this happen here?
I can't pay my bills.
I want to do my job. Why can't they do their jobs?
How do I tell them the money's all spent?
I don't know how I'm supposed to get through this.
The blue blames the red. The red blames the blue. But we blame you for the job you failed to do. You claim you work for the people. I find that hard to believe. 'Cause we're the ones that suffer. What a wicked web you weave. We've got the blues. We've got the government shutdown blues. I said, we've got the blues. We got the government shutdown blues. Is anybody listening? Is anybody listening? We've got the blues. We've got the government shutdown blues.
In the span of just a few hours, President Trump caved on the signature promise of his campaign, and one of his closest advisors was indicted in the Rush investigation.
Trump just announced there is finally a deal to reopen the federal government after a 35-day shutdown, one that includes exactly $0.00 for his border wall, the reason for the shutdown.
The negotiator-in-chief, my opening offer, give me wall. In return, you offer nothing? I accept. A pleasure arting the deal with you.
President Trump finally got Mexico to pay for the wall. They were like, all right, you silly gringo, here's the $5 billion. They stuffed it in a piñata, and they let him actually hit the piñata, and then it came out, and everybody was happy, and that was that.
President Trump on Friday announced a deal to temporarily reopen the government for 3 weeks while negotiations continue over border security. Pretty clear that Trump has not figured out how to deal with Nancy Pelosi yet. Usually when a woman is giving him this much trouble, he just gives her 130 grand to shut up.
Trump was forced to cave on the signature promise of his campaign and reopen the government without money for his border wall. After 35 days of subjecting millions of people to needless suffering and pain, Trump gave up. And he did it in true Trump fashion by rambling aimlessly about walls.
Walls work. They do work. No matter where you go, they work. We have barriers at the border where natural structures are as good as anything that we can build. They're already there. They've been there for millions of years. Last year alone, ICE officers removed 10,000 known or suspected gang members like MS-13 and members as bad as them. Horrible people. Tough, mean, sadistic. Think of that. We apprehended 60,000 people. That's like a stadium. Full of people. A big stadium. 2,000 miles of concrete wall from sea to shiny sea. We never did.
Shiny sea? also, remember when you said this?
We're going to build a wall. It's going to be a big, fat, beautiful wall.
Now, that wall sounds awesome. But tell me more about this new one.
The walls we are building are not medieval walls. They are smart walls.
Walls with brains. Got it. Now, someone told me that medieval solutions were actually effective.
They say a wall is medieval. Well, so is a wheel. A wheel is older than a wall.
But he's president. But just to clarify, we are still calling it a wall, right?
Barriers, fencing, or walls, or whatever you want to call it.
Honestly, at this point, I just like to call it quits.
And because the speech made no sense, Trump later had to follow up on Twitter and insist that even though he caved without getting anything he wanted, he had actually won.
The president wrote, quote, "I wish people would read or listen to my words on the border wall. This was in no way a concession."
Yeah, we did listen. You said suspested. We were listening. Also, if you have to tell people it wasn't a concession, then it was definitely a concession. It's like that time Custer wrote home from Little Bighorn, "This was in no way my last stand." So Trump caved after 35 days, got nothing.
Not everyone out there thinks that Donald Trump folded like an origami swan. For instance, Donald Trump, who tweeted, "This was in no way a concession. It was taking care of millions of people who were getting badly hurt by the shutdown with the understanding that in 21 days, if no deal is done, it's off to the races." And believe me, folks, I know races. Many people call me a racist.
He even did the unthinkable and lashed out at Fox News this weekend. He wrote, "Never thought I'd say this, but I think John Roberts Fox and Jillian Turner at Fox News have even less understanding of the wall negotiations than the folks at fake news CNN and NBC. Wow, Donald Trump attacking Fox News. But the best part of the tweet from our stable genius leader is that he misspelled Jillian Turner. The Jillian Turner from Fox News spells Jillian with a G. In his trademark haste, he accidentally tweeted at Jillian Turner with a J, who turns out to be a teenager from Weed, California.
On Friday, President Trump temporarily reopened the government. And I know liberals are tweeting out, "Trump caved, Trump caved." But y'all gotta calm down. Stop gloating. You didn't win yet. The man is still one tweet away from calling a national state of emergency and bringing back slavery. Act like he's still crazy. You got to treat him like you're training a dog. Constant positive reinforcement. Maybe instead, every time he does something you like, tweet out, "Who's a good boy?"
And Trump's not bluffing here. Take it from acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney.
Is the president really prepared to shut down the government again in 3 weeks?
Yeah, I think he actually is. Keep in mind, he's willing to do whatever it takes to secure the border.
Yeah, whatever it takes. Pouting, threatening, holding his breath until he turns blue, which would be a more natural color. The president, right now, his heels are completely dug in. When asked if he would accept less than $5.7 billion for his wall, Trump said, "I doubt it." So, just to be clear, he's making the exact same offer, backed by the exact same threat, but somehow he expects different results. Well, you know what they say, the definition of insanity is Donald Trump. Over the weekend, Trump kept up his push for border security, tweeting out these alarming statistics.
"We are not even into February, and the cost of illegal immigration so far this year is $18,959,495,168. There are at least 25,772,342, let's say, illegal aliens, not the 11 million that have been reported for years in our country. So ridiculous, DHS."
Those are some really specific numbers. In fact, that tweet, do I have this correct? That tweet scores exactly 4,394.907 on my bullcrapometer. And do we have it calibrated? Did we calibrate it? Because, you know, with the weather, when it gets cold, the bullcrapometer, very important. Here's the thing. Nobody has any idea where those numbers came from.
Oh, I have an idea. It's large, it's pale, and it has a Forbes magazine imprint on it. So. Yeah. Do you want to fact check me? What? What? What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. So if you're just making up numbers, why use something as weirdly specific as 25,772,342? As the Washington Post fact checker tweeted, nothing screams fake numbers more than false precision.
And with all this happening, another witch has been hunted in Kalooza-Palooza. Roger Stone, one of the president's closest advisors and friends, was arrested and charged on 7 counts, including making false statements, obstruction, and witness tampering. But Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee S. says this has nothing to do with him.
This doesn't have anything to do with the president. This has nothing to do with the president. Doesn't have anything to do with the White House.
None of these things have anything to do with the president. Absolutely nothing to do with the president. Literally nothing to do with the president. This has nothing to do with President Trump.
This has nothing to do with the president. The specific charges that have been brought against Mr. Stone don't have anything to do with the president. Well, businesses that had nothing to do with the president. The charges brought against Mr. Stone have nothing to do with the president. The charges brought against Mr. Stone have nothing to do with the president. Things that, again, have nothing to do with the president. That has nothing to do with the president. That doesn't have anything to do with the president.
Okay, so the only thing we know for sure is that this has something to do with the president.
Longtime Trump ally and advisor Roger Stone indicted by special counsel Robert Mueller's grand jury and arrested in an early morning raid on his Florida home.
FBI agents in bulletproof vests descending on his home, guns drawn.
Stone was indicted on 5 counts of false statements, 1 count of obstruction, and 1 count of witness tampering.
Well, they'll stone you when you're walking on the street. They'll stone you when you're trying to keep your seat.
The question in this investigation is whether the Trump campaign coordinated with WikiLeaks to release Hillary's hacked emails. Right? And in his indictment, Mueller says that Roger Stone was directed to contact WikiLeaks by someone in the Trump campaign. Now, was that someone Trump himself? We don't know. But if it wasn't Trump, you would expect his people to just come out and say so. But instead, they're avoiding the question like it's a friend's poetry reading.
The charges brought against Mr. Stone have nothing to do with the president. That's what I'm clear on, and that's what I can tell you about it today.
You keep telling me you're clear on that, but then you will not answer whether it was the president who directed a senior Trump campaign official to contact Roger Stone. And you may not know. You may not know. All I'm saying is
I have answered the question several times. You just don't like my answer.
No.
Those two things aren't the same.
Well, did the president know or not? Was it the president who made that direction or not?
Once again, I haven't read this document. Okay. I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to be able to get into the weeds on those specifics.
Okay. That's right. I'm not an attorney. I can't tell you what the truth is. I'm not qualified.
Now, if you're not familiar with Roger Stone, he's the longtime political dirty trickster known for his shady tactics and his bizarre outfits. Mueller arrested him on 7 counts of perjury and 5 counts of looking like Teddy Roosevelt's deadbeat dad. Stone got his start in politics working for both Richard Nixon's presidential campaigns, and he loves Nixon so much he famously has Nixon's face tattooed on his back. Although it's equally possible that the tattoo just burned itself into his skin while he was sleeping. You have the mark! And after Stone left the courthouse on Friday, he celebrated his political hero by doing the Nixon victory pose for the cameras. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, didn't Nixon resign in disgrace? Maybe that's not the best pose to show your innocence. And if I were Stone, I'd be afraid of the parallels because Nixon's presidency ended in part over charges that he obstructed justice, and the indictment against Stone alleges that he was very intent on interfering in Mueller's investigation. For example, Stone sent an email to a guy named Randy Credico, a radio host who allegedly acted as an intermediary with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And in that email, Stone tried to get Credico to lie by citing a character from The Godfather as an example to follow.
The special counsel also indicted Stone for witness tampering. This for allegedly attempting to sway radio host Randy Credico, allegedly a go-between with Assange, before Credico testified to Congress. The indictment alleges that Stone said Credico, quote, should do a Frank Pentangeli.
State your name, please.
Frank Pentangeli.
Did you serve under the Capo regime
Peter Clemenza, under Vito Corleone, also known as the Godfather?
I never knew no Godfather. I got my own family, Senator.
Mr. Pentangeli, you are contradicting a sworn statement you previously made to me and signed. I ask you again, sir, here and now, under oath, were you at any time a member of a crime organization?
I don't know nothing about that.
Stone literally told a witness to do a Frank Pentangeli, a character in The Godfather who lies to Congress. This guy was basically begging to be arrested. I mean, he imitates Richard Nixon, he quotes from The Godfather, and he dresses like Hannibal Lecter. But Stone's email to Credico got weirder. Stone allegedly threatened Credico in an attempt to keep him quiet during the investigation. And at one point, according to the indictment, Stone even suggested he would steal Credico's therapy dog. According to an email included in the indictment, Stone also said he would take that dog away from you. Man, it really doesn't help your case when you make the same threats as the Wicked Witch of the West.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
He actually threatened to steal the guy's dog. How much more of a villain can you be? I'll steal that dog of yours, and then it's off to Monte Carlo and my autogyro! And yet, even after threatening another guy's dog, Stone had the audacity to complain about the FBI's treatment of him in a courthouse press conference on Friday.
This morning, at the crack of dawn, 29 FBI agents arrived at my home with 17 vehicles with their lights flashing. When they could simply have contacted my attorneys, and I would have been more than willing to surrender voluntarily. They terrorized my wife, my dogs.
Oh, now you're worried about dogs? One after another, the president's closest associates are being indicted or going to jail. Trump says he only hires the best, but Stone's indictment is more proof that Trump surrounds himself with
horrible people.
Since it is technically not feasible to use the console for a practice, we will have to simulate the equipment by referring to a doctor. Show with your fingers, and describe where necessary what operations you perform.
Nobody knows this stuff better than me.
Nobody knows more about taxes than I do, and income than I do.
Nobody knows more about construction than I do.
Nobody knows more about campaign finance than I do.
I know more about drones than anybody.
Nobody knows much more about technology, this type of technology, certainly, than I do.
Nobody knows more about technology than me.
Nobody in the history of this country has ever known so much about infrastructure as Donald Trump.
I know the H-1B. I know the H-2B. Nobody knows it better than me.
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me.
I understand things. I comprehend very well, okay? Better than, I think, almost anybody.
And by the way, who knew the other side of the picture better than me? I knew it.
Nobody knows more about environmental impact statements than me.
I understand the power of Facebook. Maybe better than almost anybody.
I know more about renewables than any human being on Earth.
Nobody knows more about polls than me.
I know more about courts than any human being on Earth.
I know more about steelworkers than anybody that's ever run for office.
I know more about golf than Obama knows.
Nobody knows more about banks than I do.
Nobody knows more about trade than me.
Well, obviously, he doesn't know about nuclear weapons. I know more about nuclear weapons than he'll ever know.
I understand the tax laws better than almost anyone.
Who knows more about lawsuits than I do? I'm the king.
I know more about offense and defense than they will ever understand.
And nobody even understands it but me. It's called devaluation.
I understand money better than anybody.
I understand the system better than anybody.
Nobody knows more about debt than I do.
Nobody knows the game better than me.
I know more about contributions than anybody.
And who knows more about the word apprentice than Donald Trump?
I understand politicians better than anybody.
Nobody knows politicians better than me.
Who knows the other side better than me?
Who knows the other side better than me?
I think I know more about the other side than almost anybody.
And I understand the other side. Perhaps I understand it better than anybody else.
I was the fair-haired boy. Nobody knows more about it than me.
I know more than these politicians. These guys don't know anything.
I know a lot. I know more than I'm ever going to tell you.
The truth is...
altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further.
No collusion. No obstruction.
Whoa, whoa.
A horror show.
Whoa.
I don't think so.
Whoa.
Mueller's probe.
Scum on top.
And they had to be stopped.
Whoa.
A horror show.
Whoa.
I don't think so.
Whoa.
Mueller's probe.
It was for justice now with quotes. Call me CIA or somebody.
Came from me. That could be a little dicey.
Everybody lives the den of thieves, but they were nasty.
No loyalty.
Flippers.
Criminal acts.
Hold your back.
13 angry Democrats.
The media never covers that.
I say enemy of the people. It's called flipping, and it's ought to be illegal.
Crazy. Our president is crazy.
Crazy.
Crazy. Our president is crazy.
A total phony.
Crazy. Our president is crazy.
Separating the families.
Crazy. Our president is crazy.
It's not easy.
I know all about flipping. Robert Mueller's got nothing. I know all about flipping.
I'm like a ship, just keep going.
The Pfizer report, go after Manafort.
I would like to talk.
Never show up to court.
I tweeted. There was nobody to collude with.
Flip on whoever the next highest one is. I didn't want to.
Fake news.
I didn't want to.
Fake news.
No collusion.
No collusion.
There is no collusion.
There was no obstruction. There was no collusion.
No collusion. No collusion. No collusion.
No collusion.
No collusion.
No collusion.
No collusion.
There was no collusion.
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 No obstruction.
For 30, 40 years, I've been watching Flippers.
Eres un canalla, eres un malvado.
vos al ultraje, demostrabas también lo que tú eras. Mal hombre, tan ruin es tu alma que no tiene nombre.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
I'm not losing my mind. I'm giving it away. From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
A countercultural theme park were to go through and happen in Berkeley, there would be a special Telegraph Avenue fun ride every evening at sundown, right at Sproul Plaza. They would be able to surround a police car, overturn it, and torch it.
The only way I would vote for something like this, if you're going to make Telegraph Avenue this cultural neuter, is if Disney recognized and acknowledged the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender characters in cartoons. A film like Lion Queen.
She got a point. I mean, really, what about the jobs? Who is gonna get the jobs, you know, if Disney comes in here, and has this counterculture theme park? I'm just saying, who's going to be hired to play the parts of like Angela Davis or Huey Newton or Bobby Seale or Eldridge Cleaver? They all march down Telegraph Avenue on their way to Oakland. They have to be represented. Who is going to be hired to play these people?
I would advise them to hire the colorful street people who live on the avenue today to play the roles of the colorful street people. And of course, we'd need a very forceful black woman to play Angela Davis.
Oh, okay, I can see that. So what the man is saying is that we can help change these cracker theme park developers before they come and rewrite the history of Berkeley. And we can do that by infiltrating their corporate culture from the inside. Okay, here you go, see what I'm saying. We get the jobs, and then we re-educate them about the social justice thing. I can get behind that. Now, how much would I get paid if I played Angela Davis? Because I know some sisters want to do that, and I do have a resume.
Thank you. Councilperson Spoon?
Don't let these guys buy you out with their bribes and false promises. They can eat my shorts, making Berkeley's socialist and humanitarian legacy trivial. Improved working conditions will not get any better unless we synchronize our watches and get behind the times. And blind adherence to market forces will only lead us to lose our vision and lose sight of our vision and make us adhere blindly to market forces until it's a skipping record on the turntable of history.
That's true.
We must strive to stamp out creeping excellence in overserved neighborhoods and roll back the corporate colonization of the unconscious.
I'm sure that many local actors of color would be hired at minimum wage.
This is TwitWit Radio. Tonight, the 1999 Berkeley mock city council and popular belief disorders. Can you prove it? But first, an announcement from the Rossmore mystery guests.
Rossmore has announced another lecture series, Gardening for Day Traders on Fixed Incomes. And you can read about that in the Rossmore newsletter, which is always a good read.
Is the panel ready?
Ready. Let's go, love.
I think so.
10-4.
Here.
In a minute.
Fact check. The topic?
The topic is mystery religions.
The category is Better Bad News for 50 points. Give an unholy answer to this question. Is Big Brother bipolar?
What? Say again.
Is Big Brother bipolar?
Yes.
Wrong.
No.
Wronger. Is Big Brother bipolar?
Yes, no, no, yes, no, yes.
We have a winner.
Oh, yeah. Who's ahead?
Swing voter takes the lead.
What do I win?
Self-esteem is its own reward.
I can't handle too much self-esteem. I'm a self-esteem abuser.
Well, that's perfectly normal.
I have to cut back.
What are you afraid of?
The devil hates me. I don't believe in the devil, but we're frightening again, you know.
The only thing you have to fear is fear of fear itself.
Oh, okay. I feel better now.
All right, for 100 points, give a blasphemous answer to this question. Which is better, Lucifer or Satan?
I should know this.
Repeat the question.
What's the difference between Lucifer and Satan?
Lucifer wears briefs. Satan wears boxers.
Wrong.
Lucifer is pre-Christian. Satan is postmodern.
Getting warmer. What's the difference between Lucifer and Satan?
Go to hell.
We have a winner.
I challenge the ruling of the chair. Go to hell is argumentative and excessive. I appeal the ruling.
You're out of order.
No, the chair.
Stop it.
Ow.
Get off.
Stop it. Oh.
Hey.
Shut it.
Hey,
you knock it off.
No.
The chair has lost control of the conversation.
I don't need this. Here, you chair the meeting.
I have people who chair meetings for me.
Do we even have a quorum?
The meeting is adjourned.
How do you get away with this?
I have better genes than you.
Transhumanism will change that, I think.
Is transhumanism old business or new business? Organ harvesting is new business. Mind control is old business, followed by agenda approval. How much time is allotted for agenda approval?
2 hours.
Isn't that like a bit optimistic?
Roll the clip, please.
Mr. Madam Mayor, esteemed council members, the checks from the city have stopped coming. Sending us into receivership and endangering the icon, what? Head of Timothy Leary.
You had the frozen head of Timothy Leary?
Yes, Madam Mayor.
And it, because we stopped payment, it unfroze?
Well, it hasn't unfroze yet, but It's close.
And the city of Berkeley is supposed to pay for this? I mean, are we a repository for...
Have you checked with Ben and Jerry for space?
I think they already have Cherry Garcia and Wavy Gravy.
Could we save some money here, put a wig on, and use it for the Patty Hearst statue?
We could look into that.
I second that.
That sounds like a good idea.
We're not going to put any money into this. Maybe
just state your name and your district, please.
Good evening. I am Dr. Skank from the Lawrence Berkeley Lab and Radiation Facility up next to the Children's Museum up on the hill. We demand an apology from the city council for demanding the closure of our radiation facility. Not only are you standing in the way of science, but you're besmirching our reputation. Now, it is unfortunate that the Children's Museum is right in the cloud from the radiation facility. There's absolutely no danger to the public, and if there are any mutations, it's just adding to the biodiversity. Now, let me explain that we take the radioactive isotope as a tracer on the drugs, and we put it in the animal, we get lots of money for this.
You just want an apology.
You just want an apology for us, kind of, for the people of Berkeley kind of questioning your very presence in a yeah. very densely populated urban area?
Is that, if that's not too much to ask for.
Should we apologize to this guy?
No.
Get lost.
Deep Mock City Council with Ed Holmes, Chris Welch, Kurt Reinhart, Diane Amos, Betty Halpern, James King, Karen Ripley, Selma Spector, Chet Gardner, Stony Burke, Carol Denny, Hallie Hammer, and special guest Dr. Skank, Mark McDonald.
Ladies and gentlemen, your Mock City Council for the City of Berkeley.
We have been listening to the 1999 Berkeley Mock City Council. More to come.
It was a simpler time. Some of us were younger then.
Round two. For 300 points, give a blasphemous answer to this question. Which is better, Lucifer or Satan?
I can't answer that. I'm friends with both.
Aren't they the same?
Contrary to popular belief.
Contrary to popular belief, Satan and Lucifer are not identical.
Really? I need to consult my lifeline.
Russell Brand on line 3.
Am I on the air?
Go ahead.
Is this Russell Brand, the champagne socialist? I am your lifeline, love. What is it? Which is better, Lucifer or Satan?
Because of his schism in the Satanic Church of Satan, I switched to Lucifer.
Russell is such a devil. I'm voting for you, Russell.
Uh-huh. And if I win, I promise to double your pleasure for half the cost.
I love the way you corrupt me, Russell. Mm. Do you have any advice for warts?
I do. To promote or enlarge your warts, listen to me on the Antichrist Children's Hour Sundays at midnight.
Russell is such a dog.
If the listeners think I'm a dog for fingering the Antichrist, I can't stop them.
Satan was cast out of heaven for talk like that.
Heaven is a bore, love.
What did you do to be cast out of heaven?
I put LSD in the bishop's martini.
Why did you do that?
It was supposed to be a high mass.
Why don't I get invited to parties like that?
We are talking with A-list celebrity crisis actors about creeping fascism and the new normalcy.
I can't stay long.
Have you ever been shot at in a war zone?
Not at home.
Tell the listeners what the Donald said to you, Baron.
The Donald said I should never trust my bodyguards.
Is Baron being homeschooled?
I go to an elite private school.
What are you studying, Baron?
Bankruptcy law and quantum computing.
Baron has an IQ of 149.
I'm very smart.
What have you learned so far?
Capitalism as we know it is doomed. Technocracy promises to revive it, but it's just a promise. My brain is fusing with advanced computing software to lengthen my lifespan.
How'd you do that?
I should know in about 100 years. I'm just his understudy.
Ivanka, do you feel safe?
Professional body doubles like Baron and myself are deliberately put in danger all the time. It's what body doubles are created to do.
How were you created, dear?
I was created from a saliva sample. I'm very lifelike.
No more tea for you.
Swing voter has a question.
When humans and machines fuse, how will I know who I am? I mean, what part of me is real and what isn't?
There will be no debate. A new class of human drone hybrids is already beginning to populate the planet. Transhuman life forms will soon make us strong enough to survive the lethal radiation of deep space.
I'm working on that problem now.
Eventually, our bodies will become impervious to radiation, and Earthlings will one day walk on the moon.
Wait, didn't we walk on the moon in 1969? I walk on the moon. Didn't I walk on the moon in 1969?
Humans can't survive in deep space. The radiation is deadly.
I have a tweet here that says, transhumans with better DNA and brain implants will win the race to the moon.
The father of rocketry was Wernher von Braun, a Nazi scientist.
What are you trying to say?
Nazi Germany won the war.
Well, why are members of the first family bragging about who won world... Which... What is it?
It was World War 93.
You can't pin that loss on me. I'm against losing wars.
Why did you let that happen, dude?
I wasn't paying attention. I had other things on my mind back then.
Roll the clip.
Will the clerk...
Item number one, living wage law. A proposal to set a minimum living wage of $175 an hour.
I would like to make a motion that all companies that want to actually do business in Berkeley pay a minimum living wage of $175 an hour. Okay. Councilperson Banks, can you tell the truth? Could you really live on less than $175 an hour?
Oh, of course I couldn't.
Okay.
But you should. Nobody, not even aliens, should be forced to accept a living wage. Poverty builds character.
Councilman Mazzarelli.
Frankly, I'm surprised to hear Councilmember Swing promoting this. In fact, I have a quote here. You said, "I'll be damned if I'm going to get down on all fours and fight with a pack of stray dogs over the last cheeseburger in what used to be known as West Berkeley."
We have been listening to the 1999 Berkeley Mock City Council with our panel of crisis actors. I have a tweet here that asks, if Russell Brand is the Antichrist.
Me? The Antichrist?
I want a straight answer.
All good Christians believe in the devil, love. I, however, I'm not a good Christian.
That's a non-denial denial. Boom, busted, dude. All right, round seven. The category is belief disorders. For 30 points, give a misleading answer to this question. When a false flag attack is staged to appear real, who gets the credit?
Credit for what?
For best original screenplay.
Oh, it's,
Repeat the question, please.
When a false flag attack is staged to look real, who gets the credit for best original screenplay?
The producers.
Wrong.
The investors?
Wronger.
The Pentagon Special Effects Department.
We have a winner.
Man, I'm doing good tonight, huh? I never lose.
Is everything staged?
Can I have some tea, please? Hollywood has brainwashed the public. Everything we believe is horse poop. Belief disorders rule the world, and I can't say more.
Why not?
This tea is too weak. It needs more truth serum.
Honey?
Sugar, thanks.
Now tell me something I don't already know.
A fully brainwashed population never believes it is brainwashed. North Korea's... They love Kim Jong-il. Americans believe they are free. It's falsehoods that are true.
But the consensus is that...
Well, but consensus kills judgment.
I already know all that.
You don't know, Spit.
I know how to find out.
Belief disorder is a function of governance fiction. Promoted as fact. Schooling, education are opposites.
I get so confused. Just say it.
We do not have a discipline problem. We have an obedience problem. You are too obedient. Set your schools on fire and buy my book.
Arrives Tuesday if you order in 1 hour and 25 minutes.
I read that book. It stinks.
What didn't you like about it?
Bill Gates liked it.
What does Bill Gates know about literature, about Voltaire or pre-Socratic thought before Instagrams? No, he does not.
I'm writing a book on quantum computing.
My book is more entertaining. It's the kind of book you really have to read to enjoy.
Everybody has a book to promote. Is that a problem?
Does everybody have a book?
I'm writing a novel. I don't have anything to say, but I can't stop myself.
I have people who write books for me. My latest is called What I Love About North Korea.
Can you give us a sneak preview?
Well, Kim Jong-un is in love with me.
Have you been to North Korea?
North Korea is a great property.
What's so great about it?
There's oodles and oodles of undeveloped land in North Korea.
Oodles?
What's an oodle?
Read my book.
Kim Jong-un is a fictitious character, and you know it.
Fictitious villains are no threat to me. Kim Jong-un has great legs. And he throws a great party.
Kim Jong-un is the party, and the people love him.
Great wealth has always favored socialism.
Do you think so?
George Soros said that competition is the only sin.
John D. Rockefeller said it first.
Oh, yeah? I'm studying economics on the Chinese model.
Can you explain that? What is the Chinese model?
Monopoly capitalism with a socialist cover story. I'll drink to that.
Can you even name the axis of evil?
Fact check. Name the axis of evil.
TheAxisOfEvil.com with licensing rights in Tehran, Moscow, and North Korea.
North Korea is a wilderness preserve. The Axis of Evil exists in the minds of pathological first responders who cover up their crimes and run off with the gold.
Last night, I dreamed of running away from home to live in the wilderness.
Baron, do you know where the wilderness is?
Near the skating rink in Central Park?
There's no room service in the wilderness. No one can survive there. You know, the Pope told me he owns a lovely summer cottage in the North Korean wilderness.
The Pope owes me money.
I'm not afraid of the Pope. Should I be?
Fact check. Why should anyone fear the Pope?
All Jesuits, including Pope Francis, swear a sacred oath. I swear to make and wage war secretly and openly against all heretics and Protestants, to extirpate them from the face of the earth, and that I will hang, burn, waste, boil, flay, strangle, and bury alive all infamous heretics, rip open their stomachs and wombs of their women, and crush their infants' heads against the walls in order to annihilate their execrable race.
Cool, dude.
Did the Pope say that?
All Jesuit priests recite the same oath.
How many ballistic missiles does the Pope have?
His nuclear capability is not widely known.
I think Pope Francis is hot. But Kim Jong-un is hotter.
Can I go home?
And now back to our story.
K. Kim Jong-un attended an elite private school in Switzerland where he won the Stalin Prize for Best Supporting Crisis Actor in a simulated war zone. Private schools in Switzerland are really fun.
Kim Jong-un and myself, we were in the same economics class.
Was that the real Switzerland or the fake Switzerland?
The economics were fake, but the Switzerland was real Switzerland.
Oh, now I'm lost again.
Where would this country be without this great land of ours?
My company is registered in Switzerland. Switzerland is a great property.
What's so great about it?
They have better secrecy laws in Switzerland.
The mystery guest has his hand up?
Yeah, point of information.
What's your question?
Is Kim Jong-un a billionaire?
Siri, what is the net worth of North Korea's supreme leader?
Kim Jong-un's estimated net worth is $8 billion.
Okay, for 200 points, give a half-true answer to this question. How did Kim Jong-un get all his nuclear missiles?
The Russians did it.
Wrong.
The North Korean Special Effects Department.
Wronger.
Kim Jong-un borrowed them from his classmates in Switzerland.
Hey, we have a winner.
He got a loan to avoid bankruptcy.
North Korea is a U.S. vassal state. We own that country.
Nothing happens there without the approval of Jeff Bezos and the Joint Chiefs.
So what's really going on over there?
Research and development. Google has a deal with Kim Jong-un to test enslavement software on their docile, mind-controlled population who are told repeatedly that the U.S. is planning to attack them.
Kim Jong-un is the president's bitch.
The president can grab him in the crotch anytime he wants.
Yeah, it's how bullies show affection for each other.
I have an announcement.
Swing voter has an announcement.
Mother Earth is bipolar.
Bipolar?
And it's not just a rumor.
You have evidence?
It's a true rumor, dude. Mother Earth is out of her mind.
True rumors. Wikipedia?
Wikipedia is the tool of the ONA.
Do you think so?
Fact check, the ONA.
The official narrative authority, also known as Wikipedia, an anonymous crowdsourced deception engine using fact-based analysis and editorial bias to suppress alternative narratives in favor of the official story. Example, the magic bullet theory and the suicide of Building 7.
Is Wikipedia lying to me?
Everybody finds out about it sometime.
Wikipedia is a big fat liar. I feel so alone. May I rest my head, please?
For 600 points, give an unusual answer to this question.
What is the difference between normal and paranormal?
Earthquakes and lightning. This is the Berkeley Signal.